of you had caucus meetings at noon today, and so we're apologizing for those of you who were here on time. We're going to go ahead and start our presentation today. As you saw from the agenda today, we're pleased to have with us Hill Walker, who is a professor and co-director of the Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior at the University of Oregon. He's going to be giving us a presentation on risk factors and evaluating programs. In other words, the policy programs that we get a chance to look at and figuring out what to look for and what works. And then following Mr. Walker, we're going to have some presentation time for Bill Lemon, who's the executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission. So that's our agenda today. And we'll turn the time over now to Dr. Walker.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here and appreciate the opportunity to share some information with you. I prepared a packet that I'd like to just acquaint you with, and I'd also like to invite you, anytime you have questions, issues, you want to initiate discussion, please feel free to do so. These things always work better when there's a good exchange back and forth. I prepared an agenda also, and if you want to reroute the agenda at any point or change it, you know, I'm delighted to do it. And if you ask me questions about something that I don't know, I'll tell you. I apologize for the different colored packets. Some are maroon, some are blue. The reason for that is we didn't have a sufficient number of either color to supply the committee, but I thought about telling you that blue is for Democrats and maroon for Republicans, but I didn't think you'd believe me.
Blue today.
Yeah, I was going to say, I got the wrong color.
Okay. You're wrong color.
As long as you don't say true blue.
True blue, yeah, right, exactly.
We're just acting as Oregonians.
Excuse me?
We're just acting as Oregonians.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering about independents. I don't have anything for them, but just to familiarize you with a packet, on the right side, you have an agenda, and then I've made copies for you of some of the overheads that I think you might be interested in and would perhaps like to refer to over time during the session. There's an interesting piece which, Bill, I think you indicated they may have already seen or have a copy of. It's by Steve Aos of the Washington State Institute for Public Policy.
Dr. Walker, some of the members are familiar in the past, but I think most of the members are not.
Okay. Steve Aos is one of the most respected professionals, I guess, in the area of juvenile crime and adolescent violence. And he's a key researcher, policy person within the Washington State Institute for Public Policy. And in October of 2002, he produced this document on recommendations to improve the cost effectiveness of the juvenile justice system in the state of Washington. He really has conducted a nice analysis of practices in the state, trends, which factors seem to be accounting for their high costs, and incarceration, of course, is the leading source of that. And he does a nice analysis about how money could be better spent and produce superior outcomes. So I think you might find it interesting. I've heard him present several times, and he's someone you might consider, if you like, at some point in the future. I have a reputation as focusing perhaps too exclusively on prevention through early intervention. So today I wanted to present a more balanced perspective about things that can be done throughout the whole age range, say preschool through young adulthood. And one of them, one thing that can be done if it's set up correctly, is the appropriate use of alternative educational programs to keep these very, very severely involved at-risk youth connected with schooling as long as possible. There's powerful evidence that staying connected with schooling, bonding, engaging, and attaching to the schooling process is one of the most effective protective factors that we have. It protects youth against an array of health risk behaviors and destructive outcomes that tend to come into play in adolescence. Things like adolescent offending, violence, heavy drinking, drug use, teenage pregnancy, sexually transmitted diseases, school disciplinary problems, failure and dropout, and the getting off to a good start in school and being successful in school is a very strong protective factor against all of those outcomes. So it really is very, very important. And it's far better to keep very at-risk youth connected with schooling in whatever fashion you can than it is to allow them to leave, because what it essentially does is displaces the problem to another sector of our society where their risks literally skyrocket. When these young people leave school and get on the street, they affiliate with deviant peer groups and sometimes gangs, and it creates enormous, enormous problems for us all. So this chapter provides state-of-the-art information on how to set up effective alternative educational programs, what are their key features, what are the risks associated with them. One of the risks you have to be concerned about is by aggregating and congregating these youth, you create the possibility that they'll socialize each other to ever higher levels of deviance that they might not have experienced if they were not in that placement. So to forestall that, you need appropriate related services, you need careful structuring of the intervention program and instruction, and especially very careful, tight monitoring of these youth while they're in this program, and as much as you can do outside of school as possible. On the left side, I wanted to mention that there's an excellent self-report survey or inventory developed by Denise and Gary Gottfredson of the University of Maryland. They're two of the foremost researchers in this country on this population. And they're also experts with school-based crime prevention and how do you make schools more effective in trying to get these children and youth onto the right path. And they have developed an inventory of risk and protective factors called What About You? Or The Way Survey, and it measures social resilience and risk factors. It gets at drug use and problem behavior. It can be used to assess needs and factors around designing prevention and intervention programs. And it's an excellent tool for evaluating existing programs. So you can look it over at your leisure, and it tells you about the content of the survey and what the information can be used for. So I highly recommend it. I have a 9-minute videotape overview of an intervention program for families that was created in the early 70s at Vanderbilt University, and it's called the Regional Intervention Program. And it's for families who had children in the age 3 to 4 range who are essentially holding their parents hostage by severe tantruming, oppositional behavior, defiance, and so on, and parents are literally at their wits' end. This program takes them through a year-long sequence of instruction and coaching, modeling, demonstration, and so forth, and gets parents to reestablish control of the parenting process and turn these children into civilized forms of, little humans. And so it's a 9-minute overview, but there's an article here. It's about a year old, and it's called Remediation and Prevention of Aggression, an Evaluation of the RIP Program Over a Quarter Century. And this is a program where the graduates have been followed up for 25 years, and it was just reported, and the results are truly remarkable. And it shows you, I think, something about the power of appropriate interventions delivered at the right time and so on. And finally, there's a document here called Report on Emotional and Behavioral Disorders in Youth. I'm on the editorial board of this publication. It's published by the Center for the Advancement of Children's Mental Health in Columbia, at Columbia University in New York City. The editor is Peter Jensen, who's one of the foremost psychiatrists in this country. He's an expert in children's mental health, attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, and violence. And there are two articles in here I wanted to call your attention to. The one on page 7 is called Rethinking Adolescent Limited Delinquency, and I'll talk about that a little bit. But it, as new studies come online, we learn more and more, and sometimes they have a real implication for policies that have been based on earlier studies. This is an example. And it also lists about 15 effective programs for adolescent delinquents. The other article is by a familiar person, yours truly. It's the First Step to Success program, and this is an intervention that picks up at-risk children at the point of school entry and focuses on trying to get them off to the best start possible in school. And it was developed through a four-year federal grant that I had from 1992 to 96. And for the past two biennia, the Oregon legislature, through the Commission on Children and Families, has made monies available to support the adoption and implementation of this program to any school in Oregon that wants it. And so this article describes the program and its effectiveness, and also talks about that legislative initiative and what it produced. So I thought you might have some interest in that. The last thing I'd like to talk about are some these three books weigh about 12 pounds total. We have learned a tremendous, tremendous amount about this population, how to find these children and youth, what to target through our interventions, how to support them over time to get them off this path and so on. And these are three recently published compilations of effective, proven interventions that discuss not only the interventions, but how to implement them effectively. You can have the best intervention known. If it isn't implemented with good integrity and treatment fidelity, it will not produce the effects that it's capable of. So those are critical issues in our treatment of this population. So I thought I would just make them available to you if you want to come through them while I'm talking. Any questions before I start? Or? Okay. So the agenda that I wanted to sort of use to structure the information is divided into sort of three major parts plus discussion. What's the current landscape of problem behavior currently look like among today's youth? What is the role of risk and protective factors in either placing children on a path to destructive outcomes or getting them off that path and buffering and attenuating the damaging effects of risk exposure? And then when you are evaluating intervention programs, I'd like to just run through some things that I think you ought to be aware of in, to look for, to ask people who come before you promoting effective programs. If you ask them these questions and they give you good answers, then you can probably have some confidence in what they're saying, myself included, by the way. In terms of the current landscape, we've seen a real decrease in crime rates and
rates of violence in this country in the last 10 years. As you know, there was an epidemic from the early 80s to the early 90s, driven to a large extent by the crack cocaine epidemic and large numbers of youth carrying weapons, especially handguns. The rate of violence and the rate of adult crime in this country in the past 10 years has shown pretty remarkable declines. Most of the indices going back to pre-1983 levels. However, trends in the prevalence of serious violence among adolescents tends not to show the same kind of trend. Now, states vary. If you read the material by Steve Aos, it shows that juvenile crime of all kinds in the state of Washington have shown quite a steep decline in the past 7 years. He attributes a good part of that to their investment in incarceration, which does in fact work. But it's also very, very expensive. They're spending a great deal of money in the state of Washington on incarceration. These graphs are drawn from the Surgeon General's report on youth violence, which was published, I think, in early 2001. And it's authored by Dale Elliott, who's the director of the Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Colorado. Again, a highly respected expert in this area. So you can see the trends for the composite violence index for seniors in high school, for assault with intent to injure, and for robbery with a weapon. From 1980 to 1998, you see slight increases of those. There's sort of a leveling off and a drop here, and then another slight surge in each one in the last few years. So these are national results aggregated across states. This is a figure drawn from that same report. And it talks about arrest rates of youth ages 10 to 17 for serious violent crime and by type of crime. And these are the four of offenses that make up the FBI's violent crime index. So you have robbery along here. You have rape here. Here you have, that's murder, that's rape. Here you have aggravated assault, and that one is robbery. So you can see that the trends in three of the four in the second half of the 90s has taken a downward turn. But look at the rate of aggravated assault. While it shows some drop off from its peak of about 1994-95, it's still well above its 1980 level. This is a cause of great concern to policymakers because there's a worry that if these youth began to carry weapons again, this high level of aggravated assault and all the attitudes and beliefs and inclinations that go with it could create a firestorm of renewed violence. I certainly hope it doesn't happen, and I think it probably won't, but the fact that this hasn't come down is a cause of great concern.
Mr.
Yes, Representative Shirley.
And Dr. Walker, isn't that sort of what they've seen in Boston, though? They had the 10 something program there in Boston addressing youth gun violence, and it seems to me that as we're getting out longitudinally in the progress of that program, that some of these youth that were incarcerated or off the streets are getting back on, and they're seeing an upswing again in some of the youth or the violence now by those those people who are back out on the street.
I'm not familiar with
I can answer
that program, but it's an interesting result.
As chair members of the committee, you may remember that some of us went back to Boston to look at the Boston gun plan about 3 or 4 years ago, and the plan is based on a plan that originated in Portland. What they do is they target those people who are most likely to carry guns who are criminals. And at the time, they mentioned numbers were way down, but they anticipated a rise. And they pointed to a particular ethnic group, Cape Verdeans, which are from the Cape Verde Islands, and they mentioned that they are family interconnected, interrelated. And I read the papers afterwards back there on the Internet when the crime rate went up, and it seemed to be an internal ethnic issue between families. But it did. They had people who had been in prison, came out, got back on the street, and it started some kind of internal ethnic war.
So the potential is always there. The kind of latter fuels are the things that we really have to worry about. Youth carrying handguns, youth carrying high levels of education, youth self-reporting, all kinds of types and frequencies of aggression are really cause for great concern. Well, in terms of risk factors, conditions of risk, this is a national study of youth in grades 7 through 12. And it asked youth to indicate, have they engaged in these activities or experienced them one or more times in the past year. And this survey is conducted annually, I believe. In this column, you have the percentage of the responding youth population, and this is confidential. So, I think that helps greatly in terms of the credibility of the results. But this is the percentage of the responding population that had used tobacco, alcohol on a regular basis, they binge drink on a regular basis, marijuana use, other legal drugs, fighting, weapon carrying, suicide attempt, and unprotected sex. So you see these numbers range from 6 for weapons carrying, 6% to 33% for fighting. Now, of those, say this 11%, 85% of them report engaging in at least one of these others. So these conditions of risk tend to be yoked together or interconnected, highly correlated. It's rare for an individual to have just one. If you have one, it's likely you'll have one or more others. The more risk you have, the more likely it is they'll register themselves in your life path in a very negative or destructive way. The longer you are exposed to these risks, the greater the likelihood that you will get on a path leading to destructive outcomes. No one risk is sufficient to cause an individual to start offending or using drugs or having illicit sex and so on. It's usually they work in combination as a cluster, as a constellation. And it's rare to see a specific set of risks that point you toward one particular destructive outcome. Generally, it's a constellation of risks that set you up for a host of destructive outcomes. So, what are some of the problems that we see in our youth population of having these risks? Here's a list that's pretty depressing. The social and economic costs of these outcomes are mind-boggling, way up in the billions, and so on. I'll give you an example of here are some predictors of violence among youth. this top set is drawn from the American Psychological Association's seminal report on youth violence. And they call these risks here accelerators. They accelerate your movement down a path. So if you come from an at-risk background and you have an early involvement with drugs and alcohol, you have easy access to weapons, particularly handguns, you associate with antisocial groups. In other words, the people that you call friends and choose to associate with are very antisocial. And you have pervasive, heavy-duty exposure to violence in the media. These greatly enhance the likelihood of your engaging in violent, antisocial, and very, very destructive behavior. Another way to get at this is to analyze the offending record of an at-risk youth. If your first arrest occurs very early, age 10 or younger, if your first arrest is for a serious offense rather than a trivial offense, and if by age 12 you are a chronic offender, you've had three or more arrests by the age of 12, children and youth that manifest this sort of profile have a greatly elevated risk for violent behavior, violent offending. Now, can you look at an individual youth or child, do this analysis, and then predict with certainty that at some future point they'll be violent? That's where the system breaks down. You can look at groups of individuals who fit this profile and make a very accurate prediction that that group as a whole will commit a much higher rate of violent offenses in the future than a group that doesn't share those characteristics. It's when you get to the point of saying, is it Harry, Fred, Jane, or John that's going to do it, where the system really comes into play. So it points you in the direction of treating groups of youth and doing analyses of their needs and getting support services and interventions to these groups in the hope that you will offset and prevent these outcomes. Steve Carmichael, when he was the director of Lane County's Department of Youth Services, had an analysis conducted by the Oregon Social Learning Center. And he wanted to know, of the 1,100 or so youth that DYS sees annually, which ones are likely to be repeat customers that you'll see over and over and over, and which ones are likely to be one-timers. So he had researchers at OSLC do an analysis of all the data that they had available on their population. And here is the profile. If you have any three of these in any combination, the likelihood of your being a repeat offender goes through the roof. And it's your mother or father has ever been arrested, and it doesn't matter if they've been arrested before you were born. You've been a client of child protection because of neglect or abuse. You have received special education services. Special education is a two-edged sword. It operates as a risk factor because you need it, and a protective factor that buffers and offsets some of the damaging effects of the risk you're exposed to. So it's interesting how that operates. You have an early severe pattern of antisocial behavior that can be documented. And you've experienced one or more family transitions such as death, divorce, trauma, and family upheaval. Large numbers of children and youth in Oregon pass this bar in terms of having three or more of these risks. This has been replicated several times on additional samples of DYS youth in Lane County. So these risk factors, I think, are ones that you can have lots of confidence in. This is from the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and it makes a point about the risk status of those individuals who have a single condition of risk or problem versus those that have multiple problem, risk, and condition. And on all of these measures, you tend to be much further down this path and much more severely involved if you have multiple writs. And it's really true of boys. This is that same analysis for boys. And it's a slightly different pattern for girls.
Dr. Walker?
Yes?
Explain to me why that is. Why do we see such a distinction? I mean, I don't know the relative distinction given the graphs, but certainly the visual distinction makes it look very significant.
You mean between girls and boys?
Yeah, right.
Girls tend not to get referred for their problem behavior until well into adolescence. And so it tends to develop, and they are much more in need of psychological services, supports. They're much more at risk by the time a first referral happens for a girl. Boys, it's almost like you're looking for it. It's an expected phenomenon, and they tend to get picked up earlier. Another factor I think that operates is this kind of behavior is much more normative among boys in general, and it's much more less likely among girls, partly because I think females are the superior member of the human species, but they are socialized to a greater standard, you know, of what I call civilized human behavior. But when they do break that mold, start hanging out with gangs and deviant peer groups and so on, then all of these problems just, like, come rushing out like a flooding phenomenon or something. So there are many fewer girls, but those that actually get identified and picked up tend to be much more severe. So that's about the extent of the knowledge that I have about it. But it's and picking up girls, it's much more difficult to pick up girls early on because many of their problems tend to be of an internalizing nature. They direct their problems inwardly rather than outwardly. So you don't know that they're in any kind of trouble they're in.
For those who are listening, his reference to picking up girls was not an instruction to this committee. I just wanted to...
One I happen to believe.
Is it Friday?
In this committee, it's Friday.
Late Friday.
There is a subgroup of young people with these multiple problems that occur at very, very serious levels. Interventions that target that group have the potential to prevent a wide range of problems. In fact, California has a intervention program called the 8% Solution, and it's targeted at this 8% that are like Attila the Hun, Eric the Red, and Ivan the Terrible, that account for about 65% of all juvenile crime. Optimal prevention, interventions that focus on youth at risk in general, we have multiple problems, and also the use of universal intervention. You've heard this statistic, I'm sure, about most juvenile crime happens between about 4 p.m. and 7 or 8 p.m. I'm on the board for the Emerald Valley Boys and Girls Clubs. Whatever can be done to provide structured, healthy activities in those periods of low supervision where many of these youths tend to be on their own and they affiliate with each other and get in trouble. Those are just worth their weight in gold. The U.S. Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention several years ago, I think, invested $50 million nationally in boys and girls clubs, just that program alone, because they see the value of it. And the research supports it. So that's all. I know you're just dying to hear about new ways to spend money. let's see. I want to talk to you about risk factors that operate this is in your packet. Risk factors that operate in the 6 to 11 year old range. And those that operate in the 12 to 14 year old range, and then a series of protective factors that can buffer and offset the damaging effects of these risks. generally, youth, children and youth who start engaging in this problematic behavior earlier turn out to be more at risk than those who delay it and begin displaying it later on in their development. That's a general rule. It's not an ironclad rule. So the two most powerful risks for children in the age 6 to 11 range are a pattern of general offending where young children are committing quite serious offenses. It's just a pattern of generalized offending. And they start using substances before the age of 12. If you use an experiment with these drugs like alcohol and marijuana and you're 17 years old, that's one thing. But if you're doing it when you're age 10, that's a totally different thing, and it predicts something entirely different, much worse. So the earlier you start these things, the worse it is for you. Notice that the third listed risk in the early onset group is being male. Notice over here in the protective factor column that the third listed protective factor is being female. So it's back to this point of who's the superior member of the human species. High level of pervasive aggression. You're aggressive in a lot of ways, verbally, gesturally, physically, and so on. You get lots of fights. Hyperactivity, antisocial behavior, lots of exposure to television violence. Having a low IQ, having very antisocial attitudes and beliefs. These are all risks that are specific to the individual. Now, there are a set of risks that are associated with the family and the family context that you grow up in. And they're very powerful. Poverty and having antisocial parents, harsh, lax, or inconsistent discipline, a broken home, very poor monitoring and supervision of the child, and abusive parents. In school, there are very few risk factors associated with school. Schools do not cause these problems. These problems are caused by our society, our increasingly diminished capacity to safely and effectively raise or socialize our children. But schools have to deal with those failures. But we often blame schools, and they should not be blamed. At the peer group level, associating with antisocial peers and having very weak social ties, you're isolated. The profile of the school shooter is someone that's isolated, vengeful, abused and neglected by peers, sometimes severely teased. Many have mental health problems of a serious nature, and all those things mix in and propel them toward a set of actions of seeking redress for their grievances through violent means. And I think media portrayals of violence and the reporting of violent offenses has a great deal to do with triggering that, but I can't prove it.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yes,
we're going to say reporting. You mean media reporting?
Yeah, just the...
when they lead off the first 10 minutes of the evening news.
Right. I was at a conference in Florida about 6 years ago, and I watched the hourly local news every night, three nights running, and the first, I'm not kidding you, the first 20 minutes was violence and mayhem and Armageddon, and you think, you know, it's all crashing down. And what I hear is that stations get higher ratings if they focus on these more dramatic traumatic occurrences and events. So you get this idea that it's... But I think it really does have a destructive impact on young minds, and I don't think they know how to put that all in perspective.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
Bill, in that follow-up, I understand that there have been some stations around the country. One I heard was in Austin, Texas, where they actually had a criteria before they put that type of reporting on their show, and apparently did not affect the ratings. And I'm wondering if anyone has followed up as to seeing if there's been any effect on the youth. It may be just if only one station's doing it, it may not be able to be measured.
I don't know. That's interesting that there's that station actually did that.
Yeah, and I don't know if they're still doing it. I've heard that 3 or 4 years back.
The risk factors for late onset are quite similar. They differ in some respects, and their rank order differs. Some of the protective factors, I think, are intriguing. Having an intolerant attitude toward eating behavior is one of the most powerful protective factors against this whole array of risks and conditions thereof. That's where parents come in. Teaching your children values and attitudes and beliefs that support civilized treatment of others, you know, treat others the way you expect them to treat you and so on, and deal with these issues of rule breaking and violation of the law and standards of ethical behavior and so on. We have really, really fallen down in that regard. Our society gets somewhere between a C and a D, in my view, in that area. There's not much you can do about high IQ. Being female means that you're much less likely to engage in these things than if you're male. Having a positive social orientation and understanding that there are sanctions before your transgressions, that there is a connection between your maladaptive problem behavior or offending or whatever and sanctions that are, like, you are responsible. One of the most effective crime prevention strategies is something called law-related education, where district attorney's offices make assistant DAs available to go into classrooms of middle and high school students and actually tell them about law, about the law, how it works, the courts, the offenses, and what happens if you engage in these forms of behavior. Many of these children don't have a clue, and you know, they need to know. In terms of the family, warm, supportive relationships with parents or adults, parents having a positive evaluation of the child's peers, and careful parental monitoring. However, if your child brings home Eric the Red, I'm the Terrible, and says, "Mom and Dad, these are my best friends," that's a 911 call. You want to do everything in your power to get them to find friends who engage in conventional, civilized forms of behavior to be their friends. And if children don't have the skills to recruit friendships from that pool of youth, then it's up to schools and parents and others to make sure that they develop those skills and they have the opportunities to affiliate with children who behave in a normal manner and not children who behave in an antisocial, deviant manner. That is just a huge risk. Commitment to school, bonding, attachment to school, I can't tell you how important that is. There was a study reported in the archives of adolescent medicine about 3 years ago. It's conducted, it was a 12-year study conducted by Hawkins and Capitolano at the University of Washington. And they intervened in the first three grades with children, teachers, peers, and family members to do everything possible to teach these children the skills they need and to create the kind of supports and effective parenting that would help them develop along normal lines. They followed up a control group, and this group of children that got this intervention in the first 2 days, they followed them up at age 18. And out of 643 youth in the study, they found 598 12 years later, which I think is a pretty remarkable achievement. And I don't think the FBI could do that well. But anyway, it was absolutely amazing the differences between those two groups on about every health risk behavior that you could think of. And their conclusion was getting off to a good start in school, bonding, attaching to, and fully engaging with school was the real overarching
factor that made the difference. And that early support and skills training and monitoring in the first three grades of school was what accounted for these remarkable outcomes. That's one of the most impressive studies that I've seen. One final thing on risk and protections, and then I'll get into interventions in terms of what you can do about all of this. These are some protective factors that are quite powerful that can actually be developed through interventions applied over time. You can't do a lot about IQ, but you can do a lot about peer groups, schools, and communities that emphasize and teach positive social norms. You can arrange for children to have warm, supportive relationships and bonding with adults. Mentoring programs are extremely important in that regard. Opportunities to become involved in positive activities of all types. Programs like, sports in school, extracurricular activities, and then out-of-school activities such as the Boys and Girls Club. Recognition and support for participating in positive activities and developing cognitive, social, and emotional competency, ability to regulate your own behavior effectively. So these are some very, very powerful protective factors that we should take every opportunity to try and develop through all sectors of our society, churches, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, and so on. So do you have questions or comments, discussion you want to have at this point about risk and protections? And people get so depressed listening to me talk about this agenda that I offer emergency counseling or a brief Prozac prescription. It's pretty depressing, but there is a lot of hope. We know a lot.
Any other questions? I'll just comment that I think it's interesting that it just, in my mind, continues to demonstrate the interrelationship of these issues. So we're talking about this issue in a judiciary committee as we're primarily trying to focus our efforts on preventative crime, justice-related issues, but the number one risk factor is the ability of children to essentially connect to their education and their school.
Right.
And I think that just shows sort of the seamlessness of something we all have to consider as we're dealing with these tough budgets, that they're, you slice over here, but it has an impact in some other section of the way all of this sort of interrelates. So these kinds of presentations just consistently remind me of how interconnected this entire framework is. So that's just a thought I had as I was listening to the presentation. Any other comments? Just so you know, Dr. Walker, there are a couple of our members who I know have some other things that are going to be coming in and out here in a few minutes. So
do you need to take about a 5-minute stretch break? Or
no, but do you?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Then I think we ought to continue to press along.
Okay. If you take out your packet, look on the left side, and pull out this piece on emotional and behavioral disorders of youth. And if you turn to page 7, this is I received my copy of this yesterday. So this is very, very current. And it's a fabulous article. And it's called Rethinking Adolescent Limited Delinquency. A fellow named Moffitt, a psychologist who's a researcher at the University of Kentucky, highly respected on this topic, made an interesting distinction about 10 years ago between early starters and later starters with respect to antisocial delinquent behavior. His point is that early starters who are socialized to this kind of way of behaving and believing and acting from day one are at high risk of what's called life course persistent antisocial behavior. You'll have it all your life. And the older you get, the more destructive you become because you have greater maturity, more opportunities, you're more creative and more practiced. He talked about a second group, a much larger group, called adolescent limited delinquency, which he referred to as later starters. And those are youth that don't start offending or engaging in this behavior pattern
until the upper elementary grades, beginning middle school, sometimes toward the end of middle school. And there are a lot of differences between these groups. The early starters tend to be more at risk, more severe, more aggressive, more destructive. And as a rule, the later starters tend to be, you know, less so in all of those dimensions. Now, the earlier you begin your late starting, in other words, if you started when you're in the sixth grade versus starting it when you're in the ninth grade, there's a difference there. That is, you're more severe if you started, say, in the sixth grade or the seventh grade. The belief was, until very recently, that the prognosis was much, much better for the later starters, and then most of them would come out of it. You know, they've come to their senses, social maturity, physical maturity. They come from much more advantaged than disadvantaged backgrounds, and they're not socialized to it by family members. They've now, Moffitt has reported a study where he followed a group of these later starters through age 26. And he's having to revise his beliefs about this because it shows that while later starters are not as likely to commit violent acts, a large number of them continue their offending well into young adulthood. He reports one subsample of these later starters that averaged between 25 and 50 offenses per individual. Now, these are not offenses. They're not murder, they're not rape, they're not blowing up buildings, but they're robbery, they're stealing, they're cheating, they're, you know, lying on employment applications, drug use, and all of these very destructive patterns of behavior that can have a real impact on the individual's lifestyle as well as ours, larger society. So they are recommending in this review of this research that we take a careful look at later starters and adolescent offenders who are in large numbers. Most of them are male, not exclusively, but the clear majority are, and pay careful attention to their needs and to begin making supports and intervention services available to them whenever possible on a group basis. Now, with adolescents, that isn't always easy. But the more you can make group universal type interventions available to this population, the more cost effective it is, and the more likely you are to reach those that might not obviously be in need. If you turn to page 16 and 17, they list a whole series of intervention programs that are evidence-based, and they profile them in terms of the intervention, what the goals of the intervention are, the basic methods or techniques used, and special considerations that the consumer needs to be aware of. So this, in my view, is an invaluable article and source of information, but makes a really powerful point about not sort of thinking that adolescent offenders who engage in mild to moderate forms of delinquency will necessarily grow out of it. They may grow into it. And it's the same thing with aggressive bullying type behavior that you see in young children who bring it to school with them already well developed. They are actually more likely, in many cases, to grow into it than they are to grow out of it. And so nature doesn't always take its course and solve these problems. And these are two good examples. You recall I mentioned the blueprints for... Oh, no, I didn't. Actually, Dale Elliott is director of the Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence at the University of Colorado. And he has developed blueprints for violence prevention series that has gotten tremendous attention from policymakers and later as well as researchers across the country. He's put together a blue ribbon panel of experts
And they developed a set of criteria for identifying proven programs that work when tested against the most rigorous standards of science. And those are, one, evidence of a deterrence effect when using a strong research design. And a strong design is considered to be random assignment to either a treatment or a control group, or what's called a quasi-experimental design, where you construct experimental and control groups and you try to match them on key variables that might account for differences between them other than treatment. The second standard, the effects are sustained years beyond the end of the intervention. And thirdly, the intervention has been successfully replicated by other investigators independently of the developers in multiple sites and with diverse populations. This is a very, very high bar to get across. And they reviewed over 500 programs to give you an idea of the state of the landscape. This panel has reviewed over 500 violence prevention, delinquency intervention type programs, and have found 11 that they can agree on that meet all three of these criteria. And they're listed here for you: the Midwestern Prevention Project, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, Functional Family Therapy, the Quantum Opportunities Program, Life Skills Training, Multisystemic Therapy. If you heard of that program to prevent adolescent recidivism, a very, very powerful, highly respected intervention. And I won't read the rest of them, but multidimensional foster care was developed at the Oregon Social Learning Center by Patty Chamberlain and John Reed. Some of you are nodding, you know of them. That is a truly remarkable intervention that takes the most severely involved foster care youth and recruits families and trains and supports them to effectively deal with this population. So I provided contact information for you on this program, or these programs, rather. Here is a cost-benefit analysis of six of the blueprint programs. So I don't know if you can see this, but it's in your packet. It gives you the cost per participant, the taxpayer cost savings per participant, benefits per dollar cost. And just to take a look at multidimensional treatment for osteocare, the cost per participant is per case is $1,934. The estimated taxpayer cost savings in crimes avoided, services not consumed, and so on is $27,000. $27,302. For every dollar invested in that program, it's estimated there's a $14 return on that investment. And increasingly, you're seeing programs that purport to be scientifically valid being evaluated against that for how much do we get in return for the cost of the program. And that's a very, very important standard.
Yes, Representative Sherrill.
Thank you. Dr. Hill, I guess the question I have, the cost per participant, is that for the duration of the program, or is there some other element of time over which that cost is measured? I guess also then the same question on the savings.
Right.
What's the time measure of that?
I have to be honest that I don't know if it's for the duration of the entire program or it's by year. I could find out for you.
Pretty good ratio.
Yeah. It sure is. The next best one is multisystemic therapy. That's the adolescent program for preventing recidivism. And that ratio is 1 to 8. And then they go down 1 to 6, 1 to $1.30. And then some cost you more than they
I mean, they return less than they actually cost.
So those two are extremely robust. If you are interested in that multi-treatment foster care program, Patty would be delighted to come and present on it.
One other question.
Yeah.
Where is that implemented right now? Where is that being?
All over the country, Eugene and Oregon and Portland.
Through private, through public, is there county?
She has contracts from a state agency that deals with this population. I'm not sure which one it is. But it's a state agency that's in charge of these extremely serious at-risk children and youth. And it may be the Oregon Youth Authority. I'm not sure. I know she works with OIA.
I'm sure that Bill can track some of that down. It's interesting. Yeah. Isn't it?
It's a very, very exciting program.
I'll bet we've cut it.
Well, we probably have cut it. What's interesting, though, is if you look at this, and I want to make sure that, you know, and this is a hard statement because I don't know that it's necessarily accurate because you're judging lives and not necessarily dollars, but the impact is you look, for example, at the nurse home visitation, which is showing benefit per dollar of cost, is a 83-cent benefit for each dollar, which means that we're spending more on it theoretically than we're getting back in any value from it.
Now what? Oh, excuse me.
Is that an accurate way to?
No, that's correct. But the one thing to remember, and the reason that number is so low, is that the benefits of that program play out over 15, 20, and 25 years. So you don't have an opportunity to calculate the benefits of it early on, right after that program goes from prenatal through the first two years of life. But long-term studies of it over 20, 25 years shows that it prevents delinquency, it reduces child abuse, it prevents maltreatment of all kinds, it causes at-risk moms to space out their pregnancies. So if you follow them over 25 years, then those numbers are going to look very different. So that's the reason that they're so low in that program. The oldest nurse home visitation program is really amazing in terms of its long-term outcomes.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, go ahead. Well, I was just going to also note that the little note down at the bottom indicates that values greater than a dollar indicate the program's crime-reducing benefits, and some of the issues you're talking about are beyond crime-reducing benefits that aren't necessarily being measured, which makes it even more difficult as you judge these things to try to figure out, you know, what savings are we measuring? Because there's crime savings, but there's also a lot of other social health cost savings potentially.
Special education, yeah. Related services.
Right. Representative Shirley.
Well, no, I think your comments just before the chair's comments underscored my interest in knowing how these numbers relate in longitudinal terms.
Yeah. Peter Greenwood of the RAND Corporation has done some really, really outstanding work on forecasting the long-term cost benefit of early interventions versus later. Like, he shows that preventing high school dropout has the most powerful or the greatest or most favorable cost benefit ratio because you're closer to the problems that you're trying to solve, rather than years removed, you know. So,
Again, colleagues, and then Representative Ackerman. Especially in a shrinking resource environment, we've got to start stepping up, I think, to the responsibility of analyzing not only programs that are presented to us for future analysis, but a lot of the stuff we've been currently doing that's been sort of integrated into our system over 30 years without necessarily that longitudinal research comparison, and start really evaluating that, because we're going to have fewer dollars trying to do more, and the things that frankly aren't working we need to stop spending money on and start investing in the things that are. And that's that research-based approach to this issue that I hope we can sort of help facilitate through the body. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I want to ask Dr. Walker just a question based upon some information I've received over the past year. And since you're from the Lane County area, maybe you have some familiarity with this particular issue. I'm really speaking, I suppose, to the residential foster care, and I'm interpreting that to being some sort of a residential treatment for at-risk youth.
This is taking these youth actually out of residential environments and putting them with a family who then is heavily supported and trained and coached and monitored by a team of individuals based in the community.
Where would I look then under this for the residential type of treatment like Looking Glass provides?
I don't have information in here, unfortunately, on residential treatment. That's a very, very good point in terms of how do they compare. Patty Chamberlain has run comparisons between her treatment foster care model and residential treatment. And on any dimension you care to look at, the treatment foster care youth turn out better. Better in terms of outcomes, destructive outcomes avoided, positive outcomes experience, and the cost is really much, much cheaper to treat them in the community. And you have the advantages in that they're in the community.
Well, maybe my question doesn't relate to the statistics you have here, but let me just report what happened. I think Representative Floyd Prozanski might remember this, where Looking Glass, which provided residential services for at-risk youth, changed from a co-ed to a strictly female population, citing a variety of statistics, which I thought were extremely effective from a cost-efficient basis, that the girls would relate better when treated as a separate group.
Right.
For the primary reason, they were not engaging in social behaviors to attract attention of their male colleagues in the same program,
right,
thereby achieving some very, very great efficiencies.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that, and would you like to comment on that phenomena?
No, I'm not familiar with it. I'm a great fan and supporter of Jim Forbes, and I believe in his judgment, you know, in what he does.
Okay.
And I'm sure he made that decision, you know, for very good reasons. And given the effects that you cite and the reasons that were given, I'm sure that they're valid. It's very controversial. I mean, there have been proposals to have all-girl high schools, all-boy high schools. I think all-girl high schools would work better for girls. I think all-boy high schools would be a disaster for boys. So it's a potential disaster.
Okay.
So it's...
Councilman Taylor just indicated that he attended an all-boy high school. And
well, you did really well.
And I told him that it explained a lot.
Well, think what you could have done if you...
Instead of Representative Barker. Well, there we go.
My brother went to the Fork Union Military Academy in Virginia. But he would have either gone there or he would have gone to some lockup facility.
Council.
I went to an Irish Christian Brothers high school, and it was run like a prison.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't intended that way, but we had the one brother who was the ex-Golden Gloves champion in New York.
Oh, my. So he took care of problems.
He took care of all the problems.
There are a lot of ways to do this. That's great. I don't think I've given you a very good answer, but I think that probably made all kinds of sense in the case of Looking Glass.
Well, I was certainly impressed with it because it didn't involve any expenditure of other dollars. It just involved segregating the populations, and they were able to demonstrate that they could achieve their objectives much more quickly and
right,
obviously on a more cost-efficient basis.
I think that it also means, I imagine they'll find out that they have to step up their supervision and supports and so on for the boys above the level that...
Yes. Okay, I would like to, if I could, show you a 9-minute overview tape of the regional intervention program I described that was developed at Vanderbilt in the early 70s, dealing with out-of-control preschool children and their families and so on. And once I show it to you, then I want to take you through some of the results that came from this 25-year follow-up study that was just reported a year ago. Is that okay?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay.
Actually,
Representative, if you'll move over on the side, then he can sort of keep it still pointed more towards the audience. That'd be great.
Now,
you guys can move too if you want.
My understanding is Representative Parker will not bite. So,
you program, you'll see a segment of parents commenting, and then it will be introduced by Tipper Gore. So there's no political intention here.
I can go to the park because you will be attacked. I can go to the grocery store because it was so embarrassing. I had to leave the park in the middle of the grocery store and just stay calm.
And I had a sense that there was a wall building between me and particularly the older child, target child.
I just didn't know which way to turn, but I couldn't compare him to anybody else. It gave us such a shame to start seeing a lot of stuff like, what are we doing wrong? We thought we were normal, good people, but we are bad parents. We cannot get him to obey it.
Activity-based program, and it's action. It's continuous action. If people want to come here and sit down and listen to someone lecture about behaviors, it's not the place to come.
We depend on those parents themselves to actually help with the actual operation. They are the primary therapist for their child. They do have to be here with their child the whole time and work with their child and other children learning those new skills. Well, it started from really the time she was born. She was very difficult. She cried all the time. I thought she had colic. And then once Sam came, there was the jealousy that went along with that. And that's when it really became evident that there was a real problem because she referred Sam. And it was very difficult.
We've got to do something for her protection, for Sam's protection. It was things you shouldn't be doing. You shouldn't be hitting your pets. You shouldn't be running at them or scratching toward them or anything like that. Mom said, no, playing nice. He did some good coloring. 2 years ago, this would have been impossible that way. We were working towards something together, and we saw our child responding. And we knew as parents, we would have done the right thing because we'd had been a long time.
It was worth the commitment. Once we were able to stop the temper tantrums, it just life became so much easier.
But it works because it involves everybody in that child's life. It's parenting and children skills working together. And that is a much better approach than saying, your child's out of control and needs to go to a psychologist.
Families that come through the RIP program are families that are invited to change the way they've been doing things.
Okay, you may hand out one and start working on your puzzle. I just feel more comfortable being with children, and I am able to verbalize, explain to them exactly what I want them to do. And before, I don't think I was making it clear. The first thing they taught us was to catch them doing something good. And when I started doing that, Samara really started turning around because I think I was the thing that made this all the time.
That's something that I learned within the first week is just catching them being good and positives. And I saw that in the classroom environment, and it works well.
You see, the anger is just pouring with it. Now, that frightens me. Because I'm thinking, if you have that kind of explosive temper, now what's going to happen? 10 or 20 years from now.
I didn't know what I was doing wrong. I didn't know. It just didn't work on them. You know, what my mom and dad did didn't work on them. It worked on us, but it didn't on them. Rippy showed me a different way to handle them I would have never thought before. And, very good. Bo and I feel more close to him. he has slowed down to where I can appreciate him more.
So we're good at that. He can.
Thank you. You're welcome, too. He's a very strong child, and so when I would go, it would take every ounce of energy that I had to get him. And so I'm just like, she's going to train. Keep calm.
Yes.
And I'll let him know that she's angry or upset.
Yes. Good job. Thank you for getting the car seat.
Using them to help us find out what has worked for our child has just been the greatest gift. That's how it's supposed to work.
RIT provides this marvelous service where these families go, give up their time for their child, and then they pay back their time by helping other families.
Because RIT is a payback system. It's a much better way for many working families to obtain services.
We can refer somebody, a family, to RIT when they've been able to tell them there's no cost to you.
And this is such a good teaching tool to start, like you as a teacher.
It invites parents, participants in the program, to strengthen what they have learned by having to turn around and teach it to someone else.
When we first came, Tara was extremely aggressive, not very verbal. The classroom, in the classroom meeting, is a real good place for the families, the parents, to discuss what's going on and feel that they're not the only ones experiencing this, to find out that many others are going through the same situation or something worse.
When I got here, I saw a tremendous amount of people that had children as normal as mine that had the same problems, and they felt just as frustrated as I did, and it was real nice.
But a lot of parents that do come here are in almost a crisis situation. They don't know what else to do. They're getting a lot of advice from different people. And then when they come here and in a classroom meeting, it's like, everybody understands what I'm talking about.
I am so glad to hear all of y'all's comments, because I have a 3-year-old, and he's always had a very intense personality. He's real excited about the baby coming. And then when he came, it's like putting back. He hates it. And he hits, and I can't leave him in the room together. And it's very upsetting. It breaks my heart. You know, I don't know what to do about it. But I think there's kind of, and I'm learning a lot. And I've enjoyed it.
One element that's important in the RIT program is the collection of child and adult data. This data provides us with an ongoing view of family progress, child and adult progress in the program as they are taken through the treatment process.
RIT is a tremendous asset to the medical community and the families of Middle Tennessee. And I think that simply by holding families together, it makes a better community and a better place to rear children.
Not only is RIT a good idea here in its birthplace in Nashville, Tennessee, but that with appropriate adaptations and modifications, the RIT model has been able to travel to other communities and really to other countries and other cultures.
We make monthly on-site visits, frequent telephone calls, and are available for whatever kind of training and support that they need.
Some RIT programs are affiliated with school systems. Some RIT programs are affiliated with mental health systems. Some RIT programs are affiliated with social service systems. It's not so dependent upon a particular kind of sponsoring agency. I think it's any community and any agency that recognizes that doing something early and not a problem is what makes sense.
And the fact that RIT will catch the kids while they're still very trainable and very teachable makes a big difference on what can be done.
It's almost like having my son back. The wall has come down and we're communicating better, and he says, I love you, Dad.
I feel like we have a foundation for how we communicate and get along in our family that I can envision being there when, you know, they're 16 and they're 6'5".
The rest of this are really testimonials to how wonderful the program is, so I don't think you need to. And in the interest of time, I'll go ahead and cut it off. I want to give Phil time to cover his agenda with you. Just a few things on RIP. Remember I told you they have just completed a 25-year follow-up study of 40 RIP program graduates. And this is a table that summarizes their study. As preschoolers, all of them had severe prolonged tantrums, continual opposition to the adult suppressive commands, and physical aggression toward their own parents. After completing the intervention program through RIP, these children and families have been transformed. All but one of the 40 RIP graduates completed high school, and a large number went on to college and or graduate school. All but one, the same who dropped out of high school, are currently employed. During their adolescence, one experimented with illegal drugs, marijuana, and one high school dropout was involved in juvenile justice. None of them was identified for special education or as emotionally disturbed. That is remarkable when you look at those kids and the way they were behaving. There were no reports of any of them ever engaging in aggression toward parents, peers, or teachers after completing the program. After 25 years, most parents reported that RIP had helped improve parent-child interactions, and they taught these techniques to their relatives and friends and associates, so I think it really speaks well. This is a very unusual intervention. To see something this effective over that long a period of time is pretty remarkable. In closing, I just want to list briefly go over with you this list of things to look for when you are evaluating intervention type programs, or programs that are supposed to produce changes or certain types of outcomes. Is there a credible and sufficient evidence base that the program works? And you may need to call in experts to assist you in making that judgment, because as part of that judgment, you have to look at the science behind it, the kind of designs that are used, the theoretical rationale for it, and so on. Is the information regarding its effects and the evidence base behind it information you can trust? Is it reliable? Is it relevant to what you hope to accomplish by adopting the program? Cost effectiveness. It's one thing for a program to be scientifically powerful and valid. It's quite another to be cost effective. And so you really need to look at both of those. Has it been replicated multiple times with diverse audiences and sites? The RIP program is used in every state in this country and a number of foreign countries. Long-term evaluations. I know this is a hard standard, but you need to ask, do we see a difference that's sustained 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years following this program? And with many of these, you're going to have to rely on longitudinal studies that have been done by others on the program for that. But you want to look for longitudinal studies that converge in showing powerful effects over long periods of time. Like the RIP study that I showed you is currently being replicated with another sample of 40 graduates. Social validity. Do the people that consume this program, parents, children, teachers, online professionals, and others, value it, like it, see it as effective, and would they use it again? Effect size. What is the robustness of the intervention effects that are produced? A weak effect size is something between 0 and about 0.2. A moderate effect size is between 0.2 and about 0.5. A powerful effect size is anything above 0.5. An effect size is the ratio of the difference between the intervention group and the control group. How large is that? How large and how reliable is that difference? The larger that difference, the greater the effect size will be, and that's something you want to look at. How much effort is required to implement it? If it's too, you know, I have to tell you this, if it costs too much to implement it in terms of effort and time, it'll die, or it'll get sabotaged, or it won't produce the effects that it's capable of. And does it fit the context? Does it fit the cultural variables that are involved with the population and the site where the program is expected to work? Critically important variable to look at. how well does this program fit in this particular context? The more replications you have with more different populations, the more likely the program will have been adapted to take those into account or are capable of being adapted. So that's my little spiel. If you have any final questions or comments, anything you want me to respond to, I'll try and do it.
Any questions for Dr. Walker?
Dr. Walker, on your cost-benefit analysis, are you assuming or is it a fact in that analysis that the treatment programs were successful, there's no recidivism, or are you making assumptions that the treatment was successful and then calculate your avoided cost?
Those cost-benefits are calculated on the basis of services that would ordinarily be consumed but are not because of the deterrent effect of the intervention, and that would include recidivism. Steve Aos of the Washington Public Policy Institute estimates that for every delinquent act that's prevented, in other words, not there's no recidivism, you save $25,000 to $30,000.
Okay,
that's his estimate. That's quite high. It right. seems to me that's...
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
Bill, I just wanted a question. It's interesting to see the RIP program. It looks to me like it's completely a behavioral modification program.
It is.
Do you know if they were introducing any type of chemotherapy for the children, and if so...
Oh, chemical treatment?
Right.
Yeah. No, I know the developers, and they regard that as anathema. Now, there may have been pediatricians, neurologists, and psychiatrists who are putting those children on Ritalin and other type drugs.
Well, that, I mean, if I can follow up, it seems that this is one means that we're seeing in today's culture in dealing with aggressive children is putting on some type of chemical treatment or discipline.
I think it's a terrible trend. This is terrible. Chemical solutions to problems that children and youth experience is no solution. Our entire culture is fixated on chemically solving our problems. The latest one, it just kills me, Paxil? Paxil, it's for social anxiety. I think some of these drug companies create the drug and then they look for a disease condition to market it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't feel strongly about this.
Yeah, I can tell. I can tell. And I don't want those people from the health committee running up to the counter what you just said. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Walker. We appreciate it. And we'll obviously continue to be in touch with you. The materials that have been provided, colleagues, particularly I want to draw your attention again to the materials from the Washington Public Policy Institute, which does have a system in place, which we lack currently in Oregon, to really do a cost-benefit analysis comparison of these kinds of intervention programs. And it's been a desire of mine, and you'll see some legislation, I hope, later this session that would start to have us work in conjunction with groups like Dr. Walker's and others to start pulling together our own ability to do some of those analyses on programs that we're operating currently. So with that little comment, Council Taylor.
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, at the program at the University of Oregon tomorrow, Steve Aos is on the program. He will be describing
great.
The Washington State policy.
So you'll get to hear more about it tomorrow, and I hope you find it as informative as I have the times I've heard him talk about it. I won't be with you tomorrow, by the way. I've got to go to a NCSL executive committee meeting in Tucson, so I'll be out of town and we'll miss the program tomorrow, but I hope you attend. Mr. Lemon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Lemon. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. And what I tell most people when I give them that introduction is the smaller the agency, the longer the title to compensate. You're going to see me around the building and in this room in a variety of roles, both myself and members of my agency. And so I wanted to come here just to talk and tell you a little bit about what we do and how you'll be seeing me, and I'll try to wear different kind of hats or ties or some way so you can distinguish what my activity is. I've given you just a couple things to kind of get you started, and if there is more information that you'd like, of course, we'd be glad to provide it to you. Usually when I'm testifying before a group that has a member of my committee on it, I defer to them, but Representative Shetterly has left the room, so he obviously had heard me try that ploy before. The commission is a 9-member bipartisan body whose purpose is to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of state and local criminal justice systems by providing a centralized and impartial forum for statewide policy development and planning. Those are the words that you wrote and approved that established the duties of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. The way I try to look at it and characterize it for people is that we try to look at the forest and not just the trees. You get a lot of specific individual issues that come before you that aggregate into a criminal justice system, and we try to help you look at the system impact of some of these things and kind of keep an eye on the big picture. Most times you will see me here in one of two capacities. One is in discussing felony sentencing issues. The Criminal Justice Commission is the sentencing commission for the state. We administer the Oregon's felony sentencing guidelines. We collect data on sentencing trends and correctional practices and do a lot of number crunching and data analysis, and so that is one function that you'll see me here. The other is that we have the great pleasure of assisting the Legislative Fiscal Office in developing the fiscal impact estimates on crime-related legislation. So when you want to increase or decrease a sentence, when you want to make something a felony or do something else in the system that creates a fiscal impact, usually we're right in the middle of that and working with the Legislative Fiscal Office to help coordinate and identify the costs and savings associated with that. So I just wanted to kind of run through the various roles that we have. Again, our primary statutory duty that you have given us is develop and maintain a state criminal justice policy and comprehensive long-range plan for a coordinated state criminal justice system. To do that, some of the members who were here last session may recognize this. This is what we call the public safety plan. It basically gives you a snapshot of what the criminal justice system in Oregon is and what it looks like, who does what. We talk about the number of police officers, that most of them are city police officers as opposed to county or state. And just provides you a general outline and kind of an introduction to who does what in the criminal justice system in Oregon. So if you need that kind of basic information, it's on our website, or I'd be glad to provide you with a hard copy if you just let me know if you'd like to have that. The other thing that you may have seen coming through inboxes recently is we held a public hearing in December on the public safety impact of ballot measure 28, the proposed budget reductions that would be implemented if measure 28 does not pass. That, to my knowledge, is the first time that any group had sat down and gathered the human services agencies with the law enforcement agencies, with the corrections agencies, and kind of put it all on a list and tried to put the pieces together. And regardless of what your feelings are about Measure 28 or whether you think those cuts are the ones that will be implemented, I would encourage you to take a quick look at it because it does set out what the impacts throughout the system and some of the interconnectedness as you deal with bills from agencies and budgets from specific agencies. As the chair pointed out, there just is a tremendous amount of interrelations and connections that you need to know about to make thoughtful decisions. Then I think the chair and legal counsel have told you that there will be a joint meeting with the Senate Judiciary Committee and two of the Ways and Means subcommittees to, again, do a more kind of budget-oriented presentation about the public safety system, and we've been working with legislative staff and other agency staff to coordinate that. Second area is sentencing. We administer the felony sentencing guidelines. You've probably seen this little grid. This is what I call the movie version. We have about 60 pages worth of administrative rules that we have limited authority to adopt after session. So when you pass laws or make sentencing changes, then we have the ability to incorporate those into our rule structure, have those take effect, and then we come back to you the following session and say, here's what we did, and get legislative approval for that. Our rules, therefore, do have the statutory authority or authority of a statute and are treated as such by the courts. I won't get into a lot of the detail of that, but to the extent you have questions about how sentencing works, I'd be glad to spend more time with you. The other piece of paper I handed out to you is this summary of Oregon sentencing laws. You hear a lot about Measure 11, a little bit about the repeat property offender sentencing law, but there are, at the time I did this, there were about 7, and we've added a couple more since. But what I wanted to do was just lay out for you when they were adopted, who adopted them, who it applies to, and just kind of spell out some of the differences between some of the different sentencing statutes that we have. And so you can see, in terms of volume, sentencing guidelines is still the primary mechanism by which we sentence felony offenders in Oregon. In terms of the bed capacity in Department of Corrections, Measure 11 is the big dog there, because you have a much smaller number of people, but they have substantially longer sentences, and the calculation for bed capacity is number of people times length of stay. And so even if you're putting a few people in for a long period of time, that has a very strong cumulative budgetary impact. And so I hope that just kind of lays out also some of the policy choices that you'll be asked to make in terms of length of stay and who gets what discretion to make what decisions where, because those all influence how the system operates and where people come into and exit the system. Our largest program area is in juvenile crime prevention. And I'm pleased to tell you that we started out with about $17.5 million in juvenile crime prevention grants. We're down to about 15.5 now. We're going down to about 13 in the governor's budget. But we have a general fund grant program that goes to every Oregon county and is available to Indian tribes to focus on high-risk youth. And so as Dr. Walker was explaining, this is based on the risk factor criteria. You have to have two or more of those risk factors to be eligible for funding under these programs. And then every county develops a plan, submits it to an advisory committee, which also has legislator members on it. And then we approve the plans and then administer that program. Dr. Walker's institute is involved in evaluating those grants, and we will have our first evaluation report going to our Ways and Means subcommittee later this session. And so we're looking forward to working with you on that. We do have other areas of interest in juvenile crime prevention, many of which are tied to some federal juvenile crime prevention grants that we receive. Those, and so you will see either me or members of my staff here when you talk about juvenile detention, and we have some regulatory and compliance responsibilities there that are federal mandates. As long as we accept that money, we have to play by their rules. And so you'll hear things like sight and sound separation, which means you can't have a juvenile in an adult jail where they are within the visibility or can hear the adult inmates. And so we will be working with you so you understand those and try to avoid problems there. We have a limited capacity, but are very active in research and analysis. And if you do have a moment and you have questions about crime in Oregon, if you just take a quick visit to our website, you will see a lot more information on crime rates and crime in Oregon, than, which I hope will help you answer some of the kind of the basic questions that you may have. And I would add, not to make a lot of plugs on budgets here, but just so you know, that the crime rate information we get comes from reports by police agencies to the state law enforcement data systems. And under the budget cuts under Measure 28, that function is scheduled to go away. And so that means you will no longer get to hear reports of whether, usually when you hear reports in the media about crime going up or down, that is based on the quarterly and annual reports that come through law enforcement data systems. And so you're not going to hear anything in Oregon if that cut happens. It will also, when we talk about arrest rates and some of the measurements and criteria you heard Dr. Walker refer to, we won't have the capacity to provide you with that if those cuts take place. But we, again, look at crime rates, sentencing, incarceration trends, and, again, try to provide a picture of the forest as well as the individual trees for you. Then we also provide staffing and reports and assistance on a variety of issues that have been directed by this the legislature. Last session, this body directed each county to come up with early disposition programs to identify criminal cases, generally lower-level cases, that can be expedited and moved through the justice system more quickly and save prosecutor time, defense time, court time, jail beds. And so we have been working with the counties as they establish and implement those, and we'll have a report for you later this session. We provide technical assistance to local public safety coordinating councils in each county. That is a group of kind of the who's who in the public safety system in the local area. You have police chief, sheriff, DA, judges. You have mental health directors, a city representative, a county representative, and others who get together and, again, look at the system on a local basis and try to make the local system work better. We also provide staff to the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee. under Oregon law, if a person is arrested for a drug offense and has, say, $200 in their pocket, you can not only arrest them for that drug offense, but you can ask to seize and forfeit that money. And so Oregon law establishes an oversight committee to monitor that process and to make recommendations on how to make that system work more, both more fairly and more effectively. That oversight body was put in the Constitution when voters passed Measure 3. And so that is a small but constitutionally directed function that, and Representative Przanski has served on that. But we staff that as well. Last session, the legislature created a committee with a very strange name, the Law Enforcement Contacts Policy and Data Review Committee, which doesn't even have a good acronym for me to give to you, but it deals with racial profiling. We are collecting data that from the Oregon State Police and a number of local law enforcement agencies throughout the state, and we'll be working with them to analyze that data, to talk about what that means, whether we can identify discriminatory trends from that data, and then also do some work in communities where they are wanting to have the law enforcement entities and the minority communities come together and work to address those issues, and we're the body that they can come to for assistance in that. We gave our first year's report to the interim committee about a month ago when there was a much smaller group here, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you very much.
And again, the other thing that we do that you will see me here on a regular basis is working with the Legislative Fiscal Office and developing the fiscal impact estimates. I've left you with my name and phone number. My card has both our website address and my email address. If you do have constituent questions about crime or general questions that you don't know where to go, we are very good at kind of being a traffic cop and helping you through that. I've given on the second page, the back side of this letter, I've given you the names of the commission members so you know the folks in your area who would be involved in this. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we do have one piece of legislation that is the ratification of the sentencing guidelines rules that we will be coming to you and asking for approval on. So that is all you need to know about the Criminal Justice Commission in about 7 minutes.
That was great. That was great. Are there questions for Mr. Lemon? Again, colleagues, this is a terrific resource, particularly as you'll get a fair amount of correspondence about from constituents about, you know, why did somebody get this kind of a sentence, or what's the situation with this kind of a crime, and why. Those kind of questions are questions that Mr. Lemon's office can assist you with, and a lot of times you can answer the question by looking at the material or the information that's on the website or that packet that he identified, which has a lot of other information. So, anything else,
Mr. Chair? I don't see on here the website.
It's on the business.
On my business card, Representative.
Right under the.
Got it.
Executive director.
I see it. Okay, and one other question.
Yes.
And I don't. This is probably a question that I should ask folks from Department of Corrections. But I'm just curious if you happen to know whether or not after ballot measure 11 passed, there was this terrific fear and actually led to our building of additional prison beds. That Measure 11 was going to cause this huge influx. Do you know if the forecasts that were let out, I guess, or stated in 1995 when Measure 11 passed or became effective, and what they are and what the actual population is today, are anywhere near each other?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, let me take a stab at answering your question. The Measure 11, Oregon forecasts their prison population every 6 months.
Right.
And so every twice a year you will get a little booklet that talks about that. I work with the advisory committee that does that. When my predecessor agency, and before I was on board, and the agency that was abolished in 94 and we were created in 95, used to do all the forecasting and the corrections statements for the voters pamphlet. The short answer is that I think we're about at 40% of the predicted prison impact that was predicted at the time of Measure 11 passing. The reason for that is that forecast said everybody who was convicted of a Measure 11 crime, for example, you could be convicted of, for example, robbery 2 and get a probation sentence. So they said that everybody who is convicted of what would become a Measure 11 crime is going to get a full Measure 11 sentence. So even if you're getting 30 days in jail and an 18-month probation sentence now, you're going to go to 70 months. And so that's what drove that big forecast. As we have, because of the plea bargaining policies in DA's offices, they deal with cases differently. The crime rate has changed. There's been a number of factors. And just frankly, in my view, we try to take more of a pragmatic approach rather than a doctrinaire approach when we do these crime bill fiscals. And so that experience means that the Measure 11 population is still going up, and you need to know that, but what we're decreasing is the growth rate. There's about 4,000 some people who have been sentenced to Department of Corrections with Measure 11 sentences, and there's just a few hundred who have been starting. The releases with people who have served full Measure 11 sentences are just starting in the last year or so. And so the committee's discussion about, are we going to get a crime wave as people with these long sentences are getting released, we won't really know that for a while. Most people recidivate within the first year is the most frequent time, and we measure it on up to a three-year basis. So we are keeping track of that, and we'll have some information for you. But for right now, it's kind of too soon to tell. And then, of course, the complicating factor is the economy changes, law enforcement resources go down, and nothing stays the same, so we can really pick at it and know what the constants and the variables are. Did that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
Any further? Thank you very much, Bill. With that, colleagues, we're adjourned.